watching your fat little gas scows trundle back and forth through the system so arrogantly.
You could have taken one. I would not have protested. Gas crews are cheap.
But if I had, we might not be having this moment here. A pleasure denied is a pleasure redoubled, as the great sage Om Shalya penned in his treatise The Principles of Pain. A delightful work, if academic. Sliscus smiled.
I have not read it.
I doubt you would understand it if you had. Now, alas, you will never have the chance. Sliscus took a quick step towards his prey, and the cybernetic guard stiffened slightly. He fancied that he could feel their targeting sensors sliding over him, and he shivered in anticipation. The facets of his armor were angled just so to make target locks all but impossible. To them, he might as well have been a mass of confusing signals.
I might, if you were of a mind, Gaimesh said.
Sliscus felt a grudging admiration for the creature. Panic normally set in at this point, but Gaimesh radiated nothing but resignation and irritation. Perhaps he had foreseen this. He would have been a fool if he hadn't. What are you offering?
This world, its bounty. Take it as a gift. I will leave it to you.
Sliscus shook his head. You offer what I already have. Gaimesh sighed. He shifted in his chair and glanced at his courtiers.
But you do not have these. Highborn flesh fetches high prices in the slave markets.
Shouts and screams of protest arose at this, but at a gesture from Gaimesh, his cybernetic warriors beat down the loudest of them. Sliscus smiled thinly as he realized why the warriors had deployed as they had. Gaimesh, cunning old rogue that he was, had foreseen this, but such foresight would avail him little today. No, I'm afraid that won't salve my pride, Sliscus said. He extended his sword. It is time for a parting of the ways, Gaimesh. We've had a good run, you and I, but new stars beckon, and I have more interesting souls to reap. So draw your blade, meat, and let us commence closing negotiations.
I see you will not be reasonable.
Gaimesh flung back the edges of his ornate robe. He had spared no expense in modifying his pathetic flesh. Cybernetic augmentation wasn't unknown among the higher echelons of the Eternal City, but it was considered somewhat gauche to make it obvious. Gaimesh, on the other hand, had obviously wanted to see what he was paying for. Beneath his robes, he was a nightmare of primitive modifications. His jointed legs seeped steam from pneumatic vents, and the pistons of his claws dripped sparks as he flexed his hands. The armored plates fused to his corpulent frame dripped a tarry substance that might have been blood or oil or both. The rain made curious trails through it. The high autocrat heaved himself up out of his sedan chair with a bone-rattling groan. Pumps wheezed as chemical hoses flushed darkly. Prosthetic eyes whirred, focusing on Sliscus.
That it has come to this is a disappointment, Trevelyath. Our arrangement was most efficient.
For you. Sliscus swept his blade out, parting the rain. For me, it was pure tedium, enlivened only by the thought of a glorious ending. But even that you have denied me. So now I must take what small pleasure I can from you in these last moments. He darted forward, moving more swiftly than the human eye could follow. Gaimesh roared something in binary, and his automatons dropped the sedan chair and jangled to intercept Sliscus. They were thin things, designed for looks rather than lethality, but still fast. Blades sprouted from tube-like limbs, and internal gyroscopes whirred to life, turning them into spinning dervishes. To a monkey, they would have seemed impossible to predict or avoid. To Sliscus, they might as well have been moving in slow motion. The drugs in his system enhanced his perceptions to an almost painful degree. He could see everything and reacted accordingly. A single blow was sufficient to send one whirling bladestorm into its fellow, and the two automatons tore each other to pieces in a cold frenzy. A third was dispatched with a precise shot to its central processing node. The fourth he simply avoided. It spun off down the street, making a doleful noise, unable to compensate for his evasion. Sliskus clucked his tongue. Such shoddy workmanship! He heard the whine of the automaton as it finally circled back and fired his splinter pistol without looking. The automaton exploded somewhere behind him.
Kill him!
Gaimesh growled. Courtiers scattered as the six cybernetic warriors darted towards him. They wore cowls and leather coats over their mostly artificial bodies and segmented carapace armor. They were a parody of the more efficient killing machines produced by the Mon-Ki tech adepts. Crudely stitched and implanted, they were built for obedience and brute strength rather than combat efficiency. The work of gifted amateurs rather than experts. As they closed in, Sliskus gave a brief thought to calling for aid. Slegg and his coilkin were close, shadowing their employer. The Slith were all the guards he needed, though there were raiders full of corsairs within easy communications range, should necessity warrant their aid. Their auto-carbines barked, filling the rainy air with hornets of lead. Sliskus darted to the side, running up a wall and flipping over the head of the first to reach him. He drove his blade into the warrior's body as he landed and spun him around. The warrior spasmed as the shots from his fellows struck him. Sliskus braced the twitching corpse and advanced, absorbing the fusillade, until he was close enough to respond in kind. Unlike the machine men, he needed no targeting array to place his shots. Two pitched backwards, their heads cracked open by the shards of splintered crystal. Three remained, and they advanced more slowly, firing steadily. Sliskus laughed as the body shielding him continued to twitch and slid the barrel of his pistol beneath its flopping arm. He fired, knocking the legs out from under one. When he was close enough, he pivoted, wrenching his sword free. He leapt up, slashing as he landed. A gun barrel slipped to pieces, and its wielder staggered back in dull surprise. Sliskus lunged, piercing one of the machine warrior's artificial eyes and the brain behind it. He dragged the dying creature towards him and kicked it in the midsection, sending it crashing into the remaining warrior. Before the hapless machine warrior could disentangle itself, Sliskus shot it through the head. The one he had shot in the legs lay where it had fallen, squalling in pain. Nevertheless, it kept trying to rise. Sliskus set a foot between its shoulder blades and slowly slid his sword through the back of its neck. It only had a dull understanding of pain, but waste not, want not. A corsair learned to take his pleasures where he could. He heard the grinding of gears and ducked. Gaimesh snarled and swung his other hand. A hidden gun barrel emerged from the meat of his forearm with a wet, sucking sound. It spat death, or would have, had Sliskus been there to meet it. Instead, he was already moving. He holstered his pistol as Gaimesh turned.
"I will crush you!"
the tyrant roared, his amplified voice echoing from the surrounding buildings. "If you could, you would have by now," Sliskus said mildly. He bobbed and weaved, avoiding his opponent's wild blows. Gaimesh had been a terrifying warrior in his youth, but time had eroded his ability. He was slow now, boring. "This is highly unsatisfying, Gaimesh. I had pictured a rather more engaging duel. Where is that skillful murderer I once fought beside in the Arconis tributary?"
"Stand still, and I will show you, you preening lunatic!"
More weapons sprouted from Gaimesh's mottled flesh. Built-in stubbers and laspacks cycled up, spitting fire. The weapons had only a few shots apiece before they ran dry or burned out. His claws, however, never ran out of ammunition. Growing bored, Sliskus darted beneath Gaimesh's groping lunge and sliced through the feed cables that controlled his claws. Gaimesh howled, and Sliskus repeated the maneuver, this time on his opponent's legs. Gaimesh sank down with a petulant groan. He shook his flabby head.
"No,"
he mumbled. His heavy frame sagged as feedback from the damaged cables resonated through his life support systems.
Yes, Sliska said.
He lifted Gaimish's chins with the flat of his blade. He wanted to look his old ally in the eyes. The autocrat's optic lenses clicked and spun.
Why?
I told you. I was bored. And all things come to an end. Goodbye, Gaimesh. Take some small pleasure in knowing that you provided poor sport.
Wait,
Gaimesh began. Sliskus flipped the blade about and chopped through Gaimesh's neck. Gore spurted and his head rolled free. Sliskus sighed. He held the sword up, studying the fluids that dripped from it. It wasn't every day that one killed an old friend, but Gaimesh had ruined it.
Heh,
Sliskus grunted as he cleaned the blade with the edge of his cloak. Still, disappointing as this had been, he had other things to look forward to. Thoughts of his impending celebrations surged to the fore. There was so much to be done. Invitations to be sent, preparations to be made.
Murta,
he called out.
Here, my lord.
He smiled and turned. His courtesan was stepping unhesitatingly over the bodies. Behind her, he could see Sleg and the other Slith corralling those Monkey courtiers too stupid to flee. The Ophidians were coldly professional, unlike many of his followers. They could be relied upon not to get out of hand with his property, so long as they were allowed to indulge their simple-minded desires at a later time. Nearby, shuffling, broken shapes slipped out from between the buildings. Sliskus frowned as he caught sight of Jinkar and his racks. Trust the flesh-weaver to wait until the fighting was done to swoop down. The racks had prisoners of their own, and as they stepped towards the cringing courtiers, Sleg grumbled a warning. The Ophidian reared up, drawing his blades. The barbed swords could part metal as easily as flesh, and Sleg was a master of their use. Sliskus had often employed the brute as a sparring partner, and he thought Sleg a better swordsman than most. Sliskus moved to head off the confrontation, Murta falling into step behind him. Sleg settled as he approached, and Jinkar waved his racks back.
My apologies, my lord. I assumed that your warriors required aid.
As you can see, they do not.
Sliskus studied the cowering humans. Noble birth meant something different among the Monki, obviously.
These are not for you, Jinkar. Content yourself with the specimens you have already acquired.
He gestured to the prisoners the racks held. The humans had the look of gas miners, their wasted frames clad in ragged environmental suits. They were bound by a fleshy cable that emerged from the back of one of the larger racks. The meat chain flexed and contracted constantly, compensating for the struggles of those ensnared in its folds. Sliskus smiled, decision made.
We shall make a gift of these royal survivors, I think. Parcel them out according to the status of my intended guests, and send them with my compliments. Murta, you will see to it.
He used the flat of his blade to lift her chin.
But do enjoy yourself before then, my lady. Let it never be said that Duke Sliskus is not as considerate as he is charming.
His smile could have cut steel. He swept the blade aside, nearly cutting her as he did so. Then, laying it across his shoulder, he turned and strode away, accompanied by Sleg and several of his hulking coil kin. There were some pleasures yet to be had on this depressing mudball before they departed, and he intended to sample each and every one. Murta watched her master go. She sighed and turned to watch Jinkar extract genetic matter from the captives as the remaining Slith saw to chaining the rest.
"Do not sigh so, my lady," Jinkar said. "Freedom is a burden on the soul."
"And what would you know of it?"
"More than I care to. What is the name of this world?"
he asked as he removed a syringe from a dying human's spinal column.
"I require it for my records."
He shoved the limp body towards his racks, who began to efficiently butcher the carcass.
"Perhaps you should ask one of them,"
Myrta said, as she kicked a loose head from her path. She looked up as the dark sky was riven by the shriek of reavers and hellions. The cackling spire-gangers filled the skies like scavenger birds, and she could hear the screams of those seeking safety in the heights of the floating city.
"I do not speak, monkey. Do you?"
Jinkar gestured to one of his slaves, and the tongueless brute shuffled forward, pulling the edges of its ragged shift away from its back. With the tattered cloth moved down, it revealed a tumorous mass of knotted muscle studded with contact ports, each one holding a syringe. The homunculus inserted the syringe he held in an empty port, eliciting a thin whine from the creature before drawing another from its quivering back. Murta frowned. The question was ludicrous.
"Of course not. Why would I debase myself in such a manner?"
He chortled.
"Knowledge is its own reward, my lady, and it cuts as keenly as any blade in the right hands."
He flicked the end of a fresh syringe and signaled for his racks to bring him a new human.
"How long have you been his slave, then?"
"Courtesan," she corrected.
"It is much the same thing, is it not? He will not let you leave him, whatever you or your sisterhood might wish."
"If I am a slave, then so too are you."
Jinkar nodded absently as he bent to his task.
"Oh, of course. There is no denying that. I sought refuge in servitude, as so many do. If you are not a master, you must be a slave. That is the nature of things. Rule or serve. Some end up doing both."
"Vect,"
Murta said. Jinkar thrust his syringe home into the squealing human's back. He kept a tight grip on the creature's neck as it arched itself in agony. Murta closed her eyes, relishing the sensation.
"Or our own dear Duke."
He glanced at her over the human's twitching head.
"Though there are some who think his rule has been overlong."
"You?"
"Never. Long may Duke Trevelyas Liscus reign,"
he said loudly.
"May he stride the stars, a colossus, mighty and untamed, until the firmament crumbles and all songs reach their end."
A cruel smile twisted his features as he jerked the now full syringe free and eyed the substance within.
"I was talking about you."
Myrta's hand fell to her blade.
"Careful, fleshweaver. I am his, and my blade serves him."
But her words sounded hollow, even to her. If she had a chance to free herself from her eternal servitude, she would take it. There was no question of that.
"Oh, to be sure, to be sure. I'm no traitor, no backstabber. I am but a humble horrorist, cultivating entertainments for my betters."
He deposited the second syringe as he had the first, and drew a third.
"And it is in that spirit that I speak to you now. I have a name for you."
"A name?"
"A world. A world of monsters, worse than any I can conceive. A world fit for a hunt."
Murta frowned.
"Why not tell him yourself?"
"I make the blade a gift,"
Jinkar said. A third human stumbled towards him, propelled roughly by the racks. He caught the creature and easily forced it to its knees. The homunculus was far stronger than he looked. Without pause, he thrust the syringe through the top of the monkey's hairy skull and into the brain meats within. The human gave a strangled groan and slumped. Only Jinkar's grip kept it from toppling over.
"What do you mean by that? Speak plainly."
He looked at her, his stretched features expressionless.
"Sliscus has ever been one whose reach exceeds his grasp. He drives himself to greater heights of arrogance and ever closer to oblivion's edge. It is his nature. Give him a sharp enough blade, and he will cut himself.
You think this world might mean his destruction?
I think that if it happens, no one will blame you.
Murta paused, considering his words. Then she smiled.
And what do you get out of this? I lose an enslaver, but you lose a protector.
I lose nothing.
Jinkar jerked his syringe free and cleaned the tip with a fastidious gesture.
There is something on the world in question that will buy me forgiveness.
She laughed.
And there it is. That is why you need me to suggest it, so that he does not suspect your obvious ulterior motivations.
Jinkar smiled.
Even so, my lady. Is my gift satisfactory?
Murta returned his smile.
What is this world called?
Jinkar watched Murta depart, hurrying to catch up with her self-absorbed patron. If Sliskus died now, it would be amusing, but unsatisfying in the long run. Better that he perish at a time and place of their choosing.
My choosing,
Jinkar murmured.
Melianis, come here.
One of his racks shuffled forward.
Open a channel to my laboratory.
The rack shuddered, and the featureless faceplate of his helmet flickered with bands of light. The disparate sections of the faceplate slid aside with a wet hiss, revealing a flat screen behind. The helmet was a broadcast amplifier of sorts, and its wearer a living communications array. Melianis had been most put out, until that first transmission burned out most of his higher brain functions. Now he was merely one more piece of equipment. Jinkar bent forward and fiddled with the control nodes implanted in Melianis' chest and neck. He located and activated one frequency among the plethora stored within the rack's organic databanks, and his servant shuddered again. Melianis stiffened, and a stream of light erupted from the screen. The motes of light swirled about erratically for a moment before condensing into familiarity. A lean form bent over its latest masterpiece. Jinkar sighed, pleased that the sigil was still active after all this time. He cleared his throat.
Honored, Jacques!
The hololithic shape turned from some unseen labor and sighed.
Who dares disturb me at my work? I am right in the middle of something.
A thin hand gestured, and the something groaned weakly.
It is I, most esteemed master.
The honorific tasted bitter in Jinkar's mouth. Caegris Jacht was no more his master now than he had been centuries ago. The master of the Hex was a dilettante and an unskilled provocateur by Jinkar's standards. Jacht leaned forward. Jinkar knew he was studying a similar hololithic projection. All members or former members of the Hex possessed means of discreet communication with other members of the Coven.
And who are you?
Jinkar, master, he gritted his teeth. Your protégé.
The exile?
Yes, ancient one.
Despite his pretense, Jinkar knew Jacques recognized him well enough. It was Jacques who had sold Jinkar into slavery after all. Jinkar knew the ancient homunculus found his hardship amusing. Jinkar was also well placed to feed useful information back to his old coven when the mood took him. Many great works of art had only come to fruition due to his diligence.
It has been some time since your last visit, Jinkar. I feared you dead.
Really, revered one?
No, I had in fact almost entirely forgotten that you still existed. Why have you reminded me?
There was a familiar undercurrent of menace in Jacques's tone. Jinkar cringed dramatically and was rewarded with a slight twitch of a smile on his former master's lips.
I come bearing gifts, O honored teacher.
Wise. Something interesting, I trust.
A world, revered one.
Jacques snorted.
And what would I do with another of those?
It is a special world, a vibrant, savage world, unlike any other, Jinkar said.
Quickly, before Jacques could reply, he sent the information. Jacques raised an eyebrow as he studied the data stream.
This is a Mon-Ki world, but unique. Perhaps. Of what interest would such a world be to me, Jinkar?
I should have thought it would be obvious, revered one. The landscape alone is an inspiring riot of ferocity, not to mention the inhabitants. The dichotomy between savage and civilization, between superior and inferior, quite stimulating.
The hololithic Jacques turned, his eyes narrowed.
Oh?
Even better is the opportunity that comes with it.
Go on.
Jinkar licked his lips.
There is a bounty, I believe, on a certain individual of our acquaintance. Quite a hefty one as well. There may be an opportunity to collect it.
Jacques nodded.
I wondered when your treacherous nature would assert itself, Jinkar. Have you grown tired of exile at last? Are you finally prepared to humble yourself before your teachers?
Jinkar hesitated.
My talents will be put to best use in service of yourself and the others. Only through your guidance will I reach the heights to which I aspire. To that end, I bring you a bond price.
A bribe, you mean, to forgive you your many and varied trespasses?
If you wish to be blunt about it,
Jinkar said, frowning. Jacques smiled.
It is best to speak simply, I think. What are you offering?
A world of raw materials, such as we have never plundered, and the life of one who has delivered insult upon insult to our coven, not least of which is daring to give sanctuary to one the Hex has cast out.
You,
Jacques said pointedly. Jinkar shrugged.
I don't make the rules.
Jacques laughed hoarsely.
No, Vect does. And he has raised the bounty on the serpent's head considerably since Sliskus's last visit to the Dark City. Something about the theft of a tesseract device intended as a gift for the lord of one of the other cabals. But you knew that, I expect.
Sliskus might have boasted of it once or twice.
That sounds like him. Preening fool that he is, it would raise as much in the esteem of the mighty if we were to give him a suitable ending, something amusing and fitting.
I may have just the thing, revered one, but I will require aid.
Jinkar hid a smile, knowing what the answer would be even as he raised the matter. Jacques was no fool, but he was greedy for influence. A true artist was above such things, but Jacques and his followers were leeches of the First Order. Their art was not conceived for its own sake, but designed to elevate them in the eyes of those whom they might serve as flesh weavers and body crafters. Such undignified scrabbling reduced creativity to mere mercenary endeavour. Understandable in its way. Camorra was a sea in which a soul without influence quickly sank. The covens and cabals scrambled constantly in an eternal game of power and pressure, each seeking its own advantage. It was almost beautiful, like some intricate mechanism of gloriously malign purpose, when looked at from a certain angle. There was an art to such manipulations. His time with Sliskus had taught him that much. Every word in the right ear was a brushstroke on a canvas as wide as the dark between the stars. And when he had completed that great work, it would be spoken of in whispers until the day the last tower of Camorra crumbled into dust. But first, Jacques had to agree. The master of the hex nodded slowly.
An intriguing prospect, I will admit. Much to be gained, and so little to be lost.
He paused, as if something had just occurred to him.
And you will oversee it, will you?
I merely proffer the information, honored master. Make use of it as you will.
Jinkar bowed his head with what he hoped was proper subservience. Jacques snorted.
I shall consider it. In the meantime, make your preparations.
The image flickered and dissolved. Jacques had cut the connection on his end. Jinkar's rack slumped with a guttural moan, and he absently patted the creature on the head.
Oh, I will. I will, indeed.
Chapter 6. Feast and Fire. 641.M41. Feasting was a tradition. One more ritual among thousands, one more bar on the cage. To feast was to sit with your brothers on long benches, eating, drinking, singing. And at the high tables, where all could see them, the thanes and jarls would be doing the same. The only ones not singing and drinking were the thralls, forced to navigate a maze of fistfights and hungry wolves, bipedal and otherwise. Lucas crouched in the high rafters of iron-hard wood above the chamber and watched it all. From above, the feast resembled nothing so much as a mechanism of many parts. He could see the wheels of influence and aggression upon which the whole of the Ett turned. He wasn't the only one who could see them. Even he wasn't so arrogant to think that. But he fancied that he was the only one who saw them for what they were. A trap. A trick played on those long-dead warriors by their wolf king. Russ had taken a legion of brutal killers and convinced them that they were heroes. He had twisted the ancient superstitions and sagas of Fenris into a cage of words to contain his wild sons. It was a chain of illusion, holding them fast, though they could neither see it nor feel it. All except Lucas. He rubbed the back of his neck as if he could feel the collar chafing him. His perch creaked beneath his weight, and he glanced up. Five shapes crouched nearby, scattered across the rafters. A familiar stink tickled his nose, and he sighed.
Halvar, he sub-vocalized.
The name flew across the encrypted vox-link he had devised for his pack, and the shapes froze.
How do you know it was me? If you want to sneak up on someone, maybe wash first.
Lucas looked at the blood claws.
Why are you fools up here?
We followed you, Cudia said, creeping closer.
What are we doing? I'm preparing to teach Grimblood a lesson, as I promised. You are going back the way you came.
He tensed. What he was planning was bound to have consequences. Grimblood could suffer wounds to anything save his pride, and that was where Lucas intended to strike. Cudia snorted.
No! You're lucky I don't boot you off these rafters,
Lucas snarled, but softly. Cudia frowned.
We came to help. He took our glory. And I'm going to punish him, but it's better if I incur his wrath alone. Don't you agree?
Lucas frowned.
Get out of here and leave me to it.
No,
Einar said.
He's right,
Ake said.
We won't let you fight our battles for us. What do you need us to do, trickster?
The others growled agreeably, united against a common foe. Lucas hesitated. But they knew the risks, and they were right. It was their battle as well. He wasn't a Jarl to steal their glory.
Fine. You want to help? Here.
He tapped at a plate on his thigh. It popped loose from his armor with a hiss of displaced air, revealing a hidden port. Inside were a handful of crystal spheres. Lucas held them out to the blood claws.
I've been looking for an excuse to use these. Take one.
Cadia took one and looked at it.
What is it?
A hollow flash. Project a sort of hololithic mask over whoever is holding it.
Doesn't last long, only a few moments, and then it burns out. Lucas handed them out to Einar and the others.
I got them from a trader of my acquaintance. She brings me all sorts of gifts in return for certain favors.
He grinned.
These she got on some feral backwater. Archaeotech, probably. They have skjalds there, of a sort. They use them when they perform before their chieftains.
He closed the port on his thigh.
These are keyed to my appearance. So we'll look like you?
Kadir asked warily.
Aye, though it won't last long. More is the pity.
Lucas smiled.
Still, you'll get to know how it feels to be this handsome, at least for a few moments.
And what do you want us to do with them?
Dag asked. Pale as he was, he looked positively sickly in the glow cast up by the fires below. He grinned, eager to participate in whatever Lucas was planning. For a moment, his lean features resembled a skull. Lucas blinked the image away, banishing it from his thoughts.
I want you to sneak back out of here the way you came and wait for me outside. Don't activate them until I give the signal. What's the signal?
Arke asked, nervously bouncing his crystal on his palm.
You'll know it when you see it. Now, go and be quiet.
As the blood claws crept away, Lucas turned back to the feast below. It was in full swing now. Normally, feasts were held to commemorate the dead, to celebrate a victory, or to rejoice in a hunt yet to come. Hellwinter feasts were a more energetic sort of beast. All that excess energy boiled over into a mad celebration full of noise and violence. Any thrall not serving food and drink stayed well away from Jarlheim during festivities like this. Below, Grimblood stood and came to the center of the chamber. He raised his hands, and a respectful silence fell. Whatever his faults, the Jarl had a firm grip on the throat of his great company. One gesture was enough to put them in their place. The warriors of the other companies fell silent as well, eventually, as their own Jarls glared or shouted for quiet. It was hard to deny that Grimblood cut an impressive figure. His battle plate was burned black in places, and red runes had been carved on these scorched areas. They caught the firelight and shimmered eerily, exactly as the Wolf Lord had likely intended. Lucas snorted. He knew what came next. Every feast, Grimblood liked to ruin the fun with a long-winded ramble on his favorite subject. The Jarl circled the great fire pit that occupied the heart of the chamber.
The fire speaks to me, he rumbled.
His voice carried through the chamber easily, reaching every ear.
The galaxy burns, and if we fail, it will be consumed. Luckily, failure is not something we are known for, eh, brothers?
A shout went up at this. Fists thumped tables and tankards crashed down. Grimblood smiled. He struck his chest with a bald fist.
We are the sons of Ras, and failure is not in us. Whatever the battle, whatever the cost, we stand true, always and forever.
He held up his fists and brought them together.
We are the iron of two great worlds, of Fenris and Terra, hammered together by the hands of the Wolf King and forged into a killing blade.
Roars now. Bellows of agreement from those too drunk on Mjord to hold their tongues, or to notice that Grimblood was lifting lines from one of the most famous speeches ever given by their Primarch.
We are the wolves that stalk the stars, and the beasts of void and darkness fear us. They burn their worlds lest we catch their scent. They flee at the first glimpse of us, at the first sounding of our howl. They prefer the agonies of hell to the touch of our fangs. They fear us.
Lucas settled back on his haunches as a solid wave of noise rose from the feasters. His ears ached with the din. Below, Grimblood turned as he spoke, casting his gaze across every table.
Aye, they fear us, and they are right to do so, for once a wolf bites, it does not let go until its prey is dead. They come seeking slaughter, and we give it to them, brothers, measure for measure.
Someone had begun to pound rhythmically on the table. Others joined in. Grimblad spread his arms.
Feel the ground tremble and quake, brothers. Feel the echoes of the storm cascading through the stone of the mountain. Feel our world twist in its rage. It is a gift, that rage. It makes us strong. It is what our enemies fear. It is our fire, burning cold at the core of us. But like every fire since the first, it must eventually consume us.
A voice rose in a dirge, and was soon joined by others. Dolorous and proud, like the groan of a dying animal. Lucas winced. Grimblad turned to the fire and swept his hands through it, as if to capture the flames between his fingers.
Our fire is the wolf in our blood. It is ever hungry and will devour us each in its turn. But that is how it must be. Morkai comes for every man, and he cannot deny it, no matter how he might wish it. Our enemies deny death, they deny the truth of things, and so make themselves into lies. But we are the truth made flesh.
The dirge grew louder and wilder. The kill urge rose suddenly, beating at Lucas's temples and choking his throat. He forced it back, fighting for clarity. Grimblad continued to speak, but Lucas ignored him. It was too easy to get swept up in these self-aggrandizing refrains. Not truth, but boasts and lies. Grimblad was just teasing the beast, so that when the Hellwinter released its hold on the Ett, the companies would burst forth and harry the stars with appropriate vigor. It was his duty, and he was good at it.
And this is my duty, Lucas muttered,
as he reached into one of the pouches on his belt. The pouch was specially insulated, and inside rested a neat gelatinous sphere. It fit easily in his palm, immediately losing its shape as he wrapped his fingers around it. Lucas warmed the solution between his palms. It had the consistency of rubber, but with less tensile strength. As it warmed, its surface began to ripple and bubble. He grinned. The substance was made primarily from kraken ichor and drake blubber. Combining them in the correct quantities along with some form of accelerant made for a potent, if largely harmless, flammable gelling agent. He rolled the solution once more into a tight ball and dropped it into the fire pit. When it landed, the fire sprang up and out, blazing wild for a brief moment as the solution exploded. Grimblad whirled, and droplets of the gelling agent splattered across his face and armor. The Jarl staggered back as his beard burst into flames. The rest of his hair went up like a torch, and he howled. He stumbled over a wolf, and the animal scrambled away, yelping. Its cries set the other wolves to similarly voice their confusion. The shouts and curses of the warriors at the tables only added to the furore. Lucas laughed. It was going better than he had expected. Still, he hadn't intended to set Grimblad's whole head on fire. That was a failing on his part, and one he needed to address swiftly before things got out of hand. He sprang from his perch and dropped to the floor. Lucas landed opposite the bellowing wolf lord. He howled out his laughter as he scooped up a barrel of mjod from a nearby table and bounded towards Grimblad. The Jarl's eyes widened as he realized what Lucas was planning.
No!
He sputtered. Lucas slammed the foamy barrel over Grimblad's head, putting out the flames with a heavy splash. The wolf lord threw a wild punch, but Lucas easily avoided the blind blow. Still laughing, he leapt up onto another table.
All this talk of fire, and no thought given to putting it out? For shame, my Jarl! What would Russ say?
Grimblad tore the barrel apart, splattering liquid everywhere. What was left of his singed hair and beard was plastered to his skull in limp knots. He roared in fury. Warriors grabbed at Lucas, hurling themselves across the table as he ran down its length. Lucas leapt and slid, kicking up platters of food and knocking over tankards in his madcap dash for the door. Grey hunters moved to cut him off. One rushed him with a beef bone, and Lucas was forced to defend himself with a platter. He kicked his attacker's legs out from under him and leapt for the wall beyond the table. As the soles of his boots crunched against the stonework, he twisted and pushed himself towards one of the ancient chandeliers that hung from the rafters. He stretched out a hand, catching the black iron rim. Still laughing, he swung himself towards the exit. When he reached the apex of the swing, he let go and landed in a crouch. Without hesitation, he scrambled to his feet and towards the doors. He heard Grimblood roaring behind him and felt the floor tremble as warriors galloped in pursuit. He didn't look back. Lucas hit the doors full tilt, scattering thralls. As he raced into the corridor, he heard a familiar howl and saw a flash out of the corner of his eye. A moment later, five copies of himself were racing alongside him. Lucas threw back his head and laughed.
"Split up!" he barked. "Let's lead them on a merry chase, brothers! Hloya!"
The howls of the rout pursued them into the dark. Gale Runner pushed the great bronze-banded doors open and entered the Hall of Silences. Jarlheim was in uproar. Packs of grey hunters scoured the tunnels and corridors, seeking something, or someone. Gale Runner knew well enough who that someone was without having to be told. No doubt, that was the reason he had been summoned.
"I told him," he said softly to his shadow, "but he didn't listen."
He had warned Grimblood about provoking the Jackal Wolf. Anger was the rout's vice, and Lucas played on it often. Whole packs of vengeful grey hunters had been led into the depths of the Ett by a laughing shadow, only to return some hours later shame-faced and smelling of troll piss, or worse things. Bront Rocktooth had pursued Lucas through the Bloodfire Gate and vanished for three cycles, eventually staggering back with his battle-plate stained black with Kraken ichor and a haunted look in his eyes. Only the mad and the desperate tried to catch the Jackal Wolf by the tail. Lucas could be endured if you were clever. Other Jarls had managed it in their time, but not Grimblood, and now he was paying for it. Gale Runner sighed. The Hall of Silences lived up to its name. The Ett echoed with noise. All save this place, where silence seemed to swell in on itself, drowning out all sound. It sat on the eastern slopes of the mountain, a shrine to forgotten things, built by men who forgot nothing. Gale Runner frowned.
"No matter how much we might wish to," he muttered.
Here was the battle-plate of a warrior who had fallen in the months of shame, shorn of totems and markers for reasons known only to the Great Wolf. There, the tattered blue uniform of a Delsvarn warden, killed in the fall of Mas'anor Kor, a decade before Leman Russ had taken his legion in hand. The walls were heavy with shameful trophies and tokens of bitter remembrance. The air was pregnant with stories untold. It was the Wolf King who had given the Hall of Silences its purpose. To ensure that his warriors tasted not just sweet, but the bitter as well, or so the wolf priests claimed. It was one of many such shrines that dotted the slopes and crags of the Fang, tributes to past mistakes. Few warriors of the rout visited the hall these days, however. Gale Runner could find no fault in that. The air here stank of regret. The battered suits of armour that decorated the crudely carved stasis alcoves were reminders of the worst moments of Legion and Chapter. He found Grimblood waiting for him. The Wolf Lord was gazing at the contents of an alcove, his face marked with soot and burns. His hair and beard had been scorched to stubble, and his armour stank of something. Trails of grimy residue marred the grey plate, smoke still rising from it in places.
"You called, Jarl. I have come." "I have eyes, Gale Runner," Grimblood said.
He trembled with barely restrained violence, as if he wanted nothing more than to tear flesh and break bone. He fixed his yellow gaze on the rune priest.
"This is a place of contemplation.
I came here so that my anger might bleed out safely. His eyes flashed. It is taking longer than usual, for obvious reasons. He indicated his burnt features. I need your wisdom, priest.
Lucas, Gale Runner said.
Yes, Grimblood said.
I warned you, but you had to prove that you could take his throat in your jaws.
Grimblood closed his eyes.
I didn't ask you here so that you could deliver recriminations.
He ran a hand over his scalp, displacing motes of ash and burnt skin.
I have sent my Verangi to look for him.
They will not find him. He has been sighted in at least 5 different places.
Bad enough that he ruined the hunt with his pranks, Grimblood snarled. He filched the scent glands from a dead kraken and marked Hafrek's armor. Besides the stink, it lured more of the beasts right to us, drawing them up out of the ice by the dozen.
A potentially lethal prank, Gale Runner said.
That wasn't even the worst of it.
Grimblood shook his head.
Then he and those half-witted pups mimicked the cries of a wounded drake. They led Redmore and his warriors into an unstable cavern and trapped them there with an ice shelf rigged to collapse. It took us hours to dig them out.
Was anyone hurt?
Grimblood smiled slightly.
Only Redmore's pride, I admit.
The smile vanished.
They also dropped nests of bloodlice down onto Krakendoom and his huskarls, and pushed Gorison into a troll lair.
Pity the poor troll, Gale Runner said.
Grimblood didn't laugh. Gale Runner understood. The hunt had sputtered into an ignominious halt. The deep caverns were unstable thanks to the increasing tectonic pressures. The hunters had been driven back up into the mountain, where they steadily pickled themselves in Mjod, or worse, got into brawls. The wolf priests were hard-pressed to keep things on an even keel. There were too many warriors in too confined a space.
He has only got worse since. He has started at least 3 brawls and instigated at least 1 honor duel. Every jest he makes, every prank he pulls, reverberates outwards, its effects cascading through the Ett.
Grimblood sighed and scrubbed at his scalp.
The other wolf lords have demanded that I do something, anything, to rein him in.
Gale Runner said nothing. Grimblood knew he was to blame, and the rune priest felt a flicker of sympathy. The Jarl looked at him.
Krakendoom wants me to break his limbs. Gorison wants him imprisoned until the hell winter is done. Redmore had a different suggestion.
He gestured to the alcove before him.
Do you know this armor, Gale Runner?
Gale Runner looked up. The battle plate was a dull charcoal gray. It lacked the savage ornamentation so common to the power armor worn by the warriors of the rout. It was utilitarian, functional. The only symbols it bore were a blocky company designation on the chest piece and a Terran raptor insignia.
Yes, it is the battle plate of a consul obsequiari, a battlefield overseer.
Grimblood nodded.
For a time, before Russ taught us our place, those who wore this armor held our leash. They were granted the power of life and death over their brothers, and many a warrior was made to lie down on red snow by their will. They are gone now, Gale Runner said. The last of them died millennia ago.
Grimblood stared at the armor.
We cast off old ways and were taught new, better rites. No more would the kill urge be silenced with a bolt round. Instead, it was shaped and forged into something useful, something better.
He looked at Gale Runner.
But still, that urge is in us. The beast is at bay, stronger in some than others.
He was silent for a moment, then...
Redmoor wants him dead. I think the others agree, though they have not admitted it. I thought I had him in hand, but clearly I was wrong. We are not as we were, Jarl. We do not kill our own.
Grimblad shook his head.
Why do we put up with him? He's insubordinate, foolish, arrogant, and harmful. He throws packs into discord and flouts all laws and rights. Again and again he has done things deserving of death, and again his life is spared. Is he not punished? Not enough, never enough. He is a lord of misrule, Gaelrunner said. A clown, the fool in the court of Rus, speaking truth where it is neither wanted nor acceptable. Then why let him do so? Because it must be done. There must be one voice, at least, that howls against tradition, else he grow complacent.
The rune priest leaned heavily on his staff.
Lucas's weird is to move out of step with the rout. That is the thread of his fate, spun so long ago when first he was dragged off the ice. Even then, there were those who thought it best that he die. Maybe it would have been better if he had.
Gaelrunner looked at him.
Unworthy words.
Grimblad frowned.
Aye, but there is truth in them. And yet you speak as if he is a stone against which we sharpen our blades. Morkai haunts us,
Gaelrunner said after a moment.
He has dogged our trail for time out of mind, and draws closer with every century. We grow old, and our claws and fangs grow dull from overuse. Even our lair crumbles around us. Nothing is forever, not on Fenris.
Gaelrunner smiled.
No, nor should it be. It is the first and last lesson our world teaches its sons. But between these lessons, we forget. We lull ourselves with tradition and forget that things cannot remain as they are, that change is the only constant on this world, or in this galaxy. Sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worse, but always changing.
His smile faded.
With every great year that passes, more packs return from their haunts diminished, he said. Death was once a glorious thing for us. Now it is a tedium.
Grimblad nodded with obvious reluctance.
Once there were as many packs as there are stars in the sky, but as the stars gutter in the firmament, so too have we dwindled and ebbed. Fewer bloodclaws survive their wild years.
Gaelrunner studied the armor.
Weaned on legend, they seek to rip sagas from the flesh of war to match their predecessors' deeds. Few understand that those deeds, mighty as they are, have but grown in the telling, and thus pups die for pride. Unless someone teaches them otherwise.
Grimblad snorted.
And that's the trickster, then. He shows them a different path. Not all of them will follow him, but some will. To what end? Old wolves have one thing in common,
Gaelrunner said.
Cunning. Strength and valor earn a glorious death, but cunning earns a long life.
The rune priest gestured to the armor before them.
Once this was a tradition, a solid fact of our existence. Now it has been discarded. We learned new ways, different ways. He is a fool, yes, and sneaky, unprincipled, an inveterate liar and a thief, but brave and loyal to the rout.
Gaelrunner sighed.
He will not be our salvation, Grimblood, but he might ensure that some of us are there to see the wolf time when it rolls around at last.
Grimblood sighed and looked away.
He cannot go unpunished. They cannot go unpunished. It is not our way. So, punish them.
Gale Runner tapped the Jarl in the chest with the end of his staff.
But be cunning about it. Do not confine them. Let them go. When they come back, perhaps they will be wiser. Or wilder. Either way, we get a bit of peace.
Grimblood laughed. Part 2. Hunters. Chapter 7. Poison Gifts. 641.M41. Lady Aurelia Marlis, mistress of the Poison Tongue Cabal, fluttered her bladed fan before her face. There was poison in everything here, and coating every surface. It was in the wine, dripping from the pores of the slaves, and wafting like pollen on the musky air. Not unexpected, and somewhat invigorating. Already the week of constitution had fallen supine to twitch and froth, much to the amusement of their peers. They would survive, probably. Still, what was a party without a few fatalities? The tesseract pleasure gardens of the Duke Trevelyath Sliskus had been the talk of the Dark City for some time. He had stolen the tesseract realm right out from under the nose of one of Vect's favourites, and left an entire district of Low Camorra in flames in the process. Trevelyath had always known how to make an exit. Marlis turned slowly, studying the gardens with the detached air of one who had seen more than her share of social disasters. Her calm demeanour was more for the benefit of anyone who might be observing her than a true measure of her state of mind. In fact, she was excited. Trevelyath was nothing if not entertaining, and many of the great and powerful of Camorra had come slinking through their webway gates, looking to be entertained. She stood at the heart of a wide plaza of dark stone, connected to the tiers above and below by deceptively fragile-looking sets of curving steps. They had been crafted from living bone, grown and carved into shape by cunning hands. Nodules of calcification encrusted the wide curve of the edifice, forming eye-catching patterns. The whole structure rustled eerily as slaves ascended and descended in a continuous line, bearing great trays of food, cooked meats and floral delicacies from a thousand lesser cultures. Their host had spared no expense in displaying the extent of his palate. The slaves slipped swiftly through the crowd. As one drew close, Malice saw that it wore a delicately engraved golden mask wired into the flesh of its head. The mask bore bejeweled sensors that acted as the slave's eyes and ears. Its body was covered in a fine latticework of scars that proved to be line upon line of poetic verse. The other slaves were similarly decorated, each of them bearing a unique work of undeniable artistry upon their flesh. Among his other vices, Trevelyath had always fancied himself something of a poet. She took a cup from a tray as it passed by and sniffed the carmine liquid within. A good vintage, likely stolen. That made it all the sweeter. She sipped from it, grimacing only slightly at the bitter edge of whatever toxin had been added. She scanned the crowd, noting the odd familiar face here and there. Representatives from many a Low Camorra cabal were in evidence. The rabble always had the most to gain from events like this, but they weren't alone. There were some rather more influential faces in attendance, unsurprisingly. Saronai Ariensis, Archon of the spacebound cabal known as the Severed, nodded bleakly to her. She ignored the overture, as was only appropriate. Ariensis had botched a coup that had cost him his position, his stronghold, and most of his left hand. Malice had no interest in such a creature, whatever he had made of himself in the interim. Of more interest, though not by much, was Lord Zarathis. The Archon of the Cabal of the Broken Sigil stood giggling in a corner, lost in a haze of intoxicants, as some witless flesh artist described her newest work. Likely the talentless fool was seeking a new patron. Malice wished her well. As long as it was suitably shocking or stomach-churning, Xerathis would fund it. Anything to cause a bit of discord. Malice stopped her circuit of the plaza as someone gestured and caught her attention. An apparition of venomous alabaster, Archon Thindrak raised her cup in greeting to Malice. Sable hair spilled down from her narrow skull, its dark length shot through with threads of deepest crimson. She was clad in a suit of close-fitting armor, its contoured plates delicately inked with intricate and fashionably revolting designs. Malice joined her at the edge of the tier.
Thindrak, you're looking well, my dear.
Thindrak smiled, displaying teeth sheathed in black crystal.
As are you, my Lady Malice, though I am surprised to see you here.
Really, she said, silkily. Treveliath and I are old friends.
Thindrak arched an eyebrow.
He has many friends.
She gestured with her cup. Malice made a show of looking around. She had already taken stock of her fellow guests and found them wanting. Like Thindrak, they were mostly the mad, the bad, and the dangerous to know. Or so they fancied themselves, at least. Malice knew most of them for dilettantes and braggarts, though several evoked something like curiosity in her. No minor archons, these, but witches and homunculi from various cults and covens. She saw a strutting succubus clad in the turquoise and gold of the cursed blade, as well as a thin, malformed-looking creature she knew to be Caegris Jacht of the Hex, or one of the artfully crafted doubles he was reported to employ. There was even a troop of harlequins present. The warrior troubadours in their gaudy colours danced, sang, and juggled for their appreciative, if somewhat unsettled, audience. Though the clowns were undeniably Eldar, they owed no allegiance to any cabal or craft world. They were a common enough sight in Cormorrah, but were not of it. These were clad in onyx and viridian, and bore the rune of the Inverse Enigma. It was one she was familiar with. She'd had some dealings with this particular troop before. She watched them mingle and smiled. The presence of the harlequins spoke to their host's influence. While there was something to be said for Vect's cunning, Sliskus might well prove his equal in manipulation. He was able to wound an opponent with nothing more than a smile and gain allies with an appropriately timed laugh. It was a lucky thing for them all that Sliskus had no interest in being in charge of anything more than his own destiny. Nevertheless, he was still a danger. That was why she had come, in the end. Things were coming to a head in Cormorrah. She could feel it in her bones and hear it in the whispered reports of her spies. Vect might have declared this an age of plenty, but she saw through his boasting. He was worried, and if the tyrant was worried, so too was she. But worried or not, she saw no reason not to take advantage of the situation. And that meant gathering allies and identifying potential enemies. She hadn't determined which of those categories Treveliath fell into just yet, but she would, and once she had, she would deal with him appropriately. Malice felt a presence at her elbow and turned. One of the harlequins was standing unsettlingly close. She wore a mirrored cowl, and Malice was careful not to seek her reflection in its subtle facets. She had met Shadow Seers before and knew the dangers all too well.
"And what do you want, clown?"
she asked, ignoring Thindrak's look of amused curiosity. Let the other Archon think what she liked.
"We ask only an introduction, O Lady of the Poisoned Tongue."
The harlequin bowed low, almost mockingly so.
"A heart in the chest is worth a word in the ear, no?"
Malice touched her chest, feeling the dull pulse of the thing inside her.
"An introduction."
The crystal heart beat with its own strange rhythm, ever-changing and unpredictable. She had won it at great cost to herself, through means she still didn't entirely understand. That time was like a dream to her, with one memory bleeding into the next, until it was nothing more than a riot of colour and sound. A whirling, disordered dance of fragmented recollections that she could only just comprehend. Of late, she had begun to doubt that she had won anything at all.
"To our host, most gentle lady," the harlequin clarified.
Malice smiled. They often came to her with some request or other. It seemed only prudent to acquiesce, and on the rare occasions that she refused, they accepted with great equanimity, as if it had been foreseen or not unexpected. In some way, she was a part of their great dance. It frustrated her to no end, though admittedly it made an often otherwise interminable existence somewhat entertaining. "And what would a troop of vagabonds such as yourselves want with him?" she asked slyly. "What corkscrew scheme twists away behind that pretty face?" She gestured to the Shadow Seer's featureless mask with her fan.
"Do you truly wish to know the answer, O bearer of the blade?"
Malice's eyes darted down to the sword sheathed on her hip. It was the same one she had used to dig out her own heart so that she might replace it with the crystal one now throbbing in its place. Like the crystal heart, it had a mind of its own at times. She dropped a hand to the grinning face that acted as its pommel and frowned.
"No, I don't suppose I do," she said slowly. "Though it had best not interfere with my own plans, clown." "The gods forfend, sweet lady," the Shadow Seer said obsequiously. "It is all part of the same great dance, though the steps are separate."
As if to emphasize the point, the clown did a little jig, bouncing on the balls of her feet. Malice frowned, then nodded.
"I will introduce you."
She flipped open her fan and waved it briskly. "If only to see what happens next. Trevelyath is quite volatile. He may well take offence to you and confine your troop to his garden." The harlequin hesitated, and Malice smiled. She folded her fan and tapped the clown on the chest.
"He does so like his little jokes, our serpent."
A sharp whistle brought the harlequin around. The rest of its troop had gathered nearby, and slaves were quickly clearing a space for them. The harlequin bowed to her.
"I hope you will enjoy the performance, mistress. It is an old one, but of great meaning in these fraught times."
"I'm sure I will.
Be off with you."
Malice gestured dismissively. The Shadow Seer spun away, not quite dancing back towards her fellows. One of the more off-putting habits of the Laughing God's servants was their seeming inability to remain still for very long. It was as if they were moving to a beat only they could hear. The Shadow Seer rose to her full height, surrounded by her troop as they knelt about her in a wide circle. Thindrak leaned towards Malice, and she hid a start. She had almost forgotten that the other Archon was there.
"It has been some time since I last saw a troop of harlequins perform. Sliskus truly spared no expense. If I thought he had invited them here, rather than them just showing up of their own volition, I might agree with you."
Malice waved her fan at the other Archon.
"Shush now. The dance is beginning."
It was hard to say just how it began, or what the first step was. One moment stillness, the next a reeling chromatic gavotte. As the harlequins moved, they left blurred after-images in their wake, ghostly echoes of each twist and turn in their grand coordination. Each step and gesture established characters whose arcs were completed by the next pirouette, a self-contained universe of transitory events bestriding an ever-shifting array of worlds. Slowly, surely, the crowd fell silent. Malice pressed her fan to her chest and tried to ignore the sudden thump of her heart as the rhythm of the dance sped up. It was hard to follow all of the nuances of the performer's body language. She suspected the meaning was different depending on where you were standing. The one she saw was familiar, a mythic saga, the journey of a young prince exiled and become king of exiles. Appropriate, perhaps, given their host. As the dance reached a crescendo of frenetic motion, there was a low, deep tolling, as of some great bell. The toll shuddered out, causing the glass in her hand to quiver in sympathy. Trays rattled, and slaves quailed, sinking to their knees. The harlequins broke apart, dispersing swiftly like a flock of startled birds. Sliskus made his entrance in grand style. Clad in shimmering raiment made from the glistening hide of some alien beast, he descended from on high. His slith bodyguards undulated after him, their progress slow. The steps had not been designed with serpentine bodies in mind. Sliskus quickly outpaced them, moving with light-footed grace.
"They say the Harlequins taught him to dance," Thindrak murmured, watching him. "And that he has done so under a grinning mask for the unknowing entertainment of the highest of the high."
She glanced at Malice.
"Have we seen him, I wonder?" "I feel certain we would know. Trevelyath has never been one to conceal his light, even for a joke."
Malice studied the corsair. Sliskus had not changed much since their last encounter. He was still the same serpent, tall and regal, as only a scion of the semi-extinct noble houses could be, with sharp, high-planed features. His hair had been bound into hundreds of thin plaits, each wrapped in gold wire. The plaits splayed out across his shoulders and cascaded down his back and across his bare chest. A pair of swords hung from the stacked half-sheaths of the ornate gem-studded harness he wore over his shimmering coat. The weapons were old and cruel-looking, their pale blades curved and hooked like talons, and they rasped against one another. The gems in the harness flickered strangely as the light struck them. With a start, Malice realized that they were spirit stones. She laughed softly in delight, wondering if the stones were occupied. If so, she hoped the souls within were enjoying the view. Holstered opposite the swords was a heavy liquefier pistol with ivory framework and a gilded barrel. The pistol, like the swords, was old and radiated the malice of ages. Fingers heavy with rings tapped against the pistol's grip, and Sliskus's other hand rested atop the pommel of the uppermost sword.
"I have arrived," he said, his voice a soothing purr. "Now, let the revelries begin."
Duke Sliskus took in the crowd at a glance, savoring their adulation and envy. The barely restrained rage of jealous Comorites was like a palate cleanser after the unsubtle emotions he had been forced to subsist on. So many different permutations of desire and resentment, and all for him.
"My friends," he said, spreading his arms, "be welcome. All that I have is yours. Enjoy yourselves to the fullest. I ask only that you leave behind a little of the happiness that you bring."
A smattering of applause greeted his words, as he had known it would. As he studied the crowd, noting the familiar faces, he wondered which of them would be lost to the pleasure gardens. He hoped it was someone interesting this time. Before he could continue, a voice cried out,
"Death to the serpent!"
A moment later, a splinter pistol crackled. The shot struck the force shield surrounding him, and the thin shards of crystal scattered across an unseen curve. He chuckled.
Oh, are we getting this out of the way early? How thoughtful!
Several guests laughed. Others drew back, eager to witness the confrontation. It wasn't a real party until someone tried to kill the host. There was a disturbance at the back of the crowd as his attackers forced their way towards him. An Archon and his retinue, three Kabbalite warriors, likely favored, if not trusted, Drakons. Sliskus recognized the burgundy armor and flowing azure silks of the warriors instantly.
"Is that you, Zomil? I thought I recognized your distinctive squeal. Still angry about the Tesseract, I take it."
Sliskus waved Sleg and his coilkin back as he descended the final steps.
"I can't blame you. It is very nice."
He gestured about him for emphasis, and an appreciative titter ran through his guests.
"Thief!"
Zomil spat. He was a pinch-faced trueborn, haughty and arrogant. He and his cluster of warriors bore the sigil of the Cabal of the Black Heart, proudly, as if their allegiance to the Supreme Overlord of Camorra was all the protection they needed. And in most cases it was. But not here. Vect had no power here, whatever a fool like Zomil might think. The Archon spat on the floor and gestured with his smoking pistol.
I name you thief and traitor, Trevelyath Sliskus. I name you coward.
He holstered his weapon and let his hand fall to the sword sheathed on his hip.
Asdrubal Vect sends his regards, Corsair. Will you answer his challenge?
A murmur swept through the crowd. Sliskus smiled.
Asdrubal sent you. How considerate.
He let his hands drift towards the swords on his hip.
Come then, let us commence, before the roasted hemovore cutlets grow cold.
Zomil snarled an order, and his warriors drew their blades and surged forward. There was another murmur at this. It was bad form to involve others in a direct challenge, but neither Zomil nor his master were known for caring much about form, and in the end, results were all that really mattered. Sliskus sprang to meet them, drawing his swords. The blades were light in his hand, and the pale steel was lined with thin filaments of red. The psychovampiric circuitry woven into the metal could leech the vitality from anything the blades bit into. He spun the swords, indulging his sense of melodrama. But as the first of his assailants reached him, he was already moving. Not to kill, but simply to incapacitate. He twisted away from a lunge and chopped through the back of the warrior's legs. His blade easily bit through armor and flesh, and the crippled warrior collapsed with a gasp of pain. Sliskus tore his blade free as he used its mate to parry a blow. Without slowing, he dealt his second attacker a deceptively gentle blow on the shoulder. As the second reeled, the third pounced. Sliskus caught her blow on his crossed blades. He jerked his swords apart, chopping through her own. She stumbled back, and he pursued. His blades licked out, knees, elbows, thighs, shoulders, and she fell with a wail. The second warrior cursed and sprang at his back. Sliskus reversed his blades and thrust them to meet him. The weight of the dying fighter crashed against him, and Sliskus shuddered as he drank in his opponent's death agonies. He tore his blades free as Zomil tried to capitalize on the momentary distraction. Invigorated by the pain of the warriors he had wounded, Sliskus easily avoided the thrust. Zomil was not quite the swordsman he fancied himself. He was a better bootlick by far. Sliskus wondered what had given him the courage to attempt so bold a murder. Maybe it wasn't courage so much as stupidity.
"How he must dislike you, Zomil," he said as he stepped around the Archon.
His blade licked out lazily, and Zomil parried it with desperate speed.
"Sending you here like this. I did wonder, you know. The last time I invited him to a party, he sent mandrakes. They made quite the mess. But this, you, this is more in the way of an apology."
Zomil bared his teeth and attacked. Sliskus ducked and twisted, evading the darting blade in a swirl of robes.
"I wonder, is this punishment, perhaps, for losing the Tesseract in the first place? It was a gift, after all. Bad form to lose a gift from the tyrant."
"You stole it!" Zomil snarled.
"Yes, from you. So whose fault is it, truly? Whom does he hold responsible, hm?"
Sliskus parried a clumsy blow and stepped past Zomil, slicing through his calf. Zomil sank to one knee with a groan. Sliskus turned and swept the tip of a blade across Zomil's wrist, cutting tendons. Zomil dropped his blade. The Archon threw himself forward, clawing for his splinter pistol. Sliskus didn't give him a chance to fire. He leapt and pinned Zomil's hand to the floor. He kicked the pistol away and smiled down at his would-be assassin.
"I think we both know the answer to that."
Zomil gaped up at him. Sliskus waited for him to curse, to protest, something. Instead, Zomil whimpered as the psycho-vampiric circuitry did its work. Sliskus frowned, suddenly bored of the whole affair. He sighed and thrust his other blade through the wounded Archon's eye, ending the game abruptly.
"Well, that was disappointing. Still, no reason to let it ruin the party."
He nudged the body out of the way with his foot, and looked around.
"Eat, my friends, drink, make merry, for tomorrow you might wind up like poor Zomil there."
Laughter swept the gardens as his guests set to enjoying themselves. He cleaned his blades on his raiment as slaves came to drag the bodies away, both the living and the dead. The survivors might yet find a place in his fleet if they lasted the night. Or he would toss them into the depths of the gardens to live out the rest of their days as hunted beasts. It would depend on his mood. As he sheathed his swords, Murta came forward, holding a new robe for him. This one had been made from the soft flesh of Moralian younglings, and its folds were dark and supple. He dropped his blood-spattered raiment to the floor and slipped on the new robe. Slaves squabbled over the discarded one, though whether to clean it or claim it he couldn't say. Either was acceptable. He rarely wore the same thing twice, and even then only under protest. He tapped the hilts of his swords, feeling the last ergs of stolen vitality seeping away. The spirit stones that encrusted the sheath pulsed despairingly, and he smiled.
"Pleased with yourself, then?"
He turned, his smile widening.
"Aurelia, you came! Oh, how delightful!"
He held out his hands to Lady Malice, and she took them, looking him up and down. Malice looked as regal as ever, clad as she was in ornate ceremonial armour and a flowing dress of archaic style. A bustle draped with streamers of Ur-Ghul hide completed the ensemble. He ignored a flicker of jealousy. She had always known how to dress for a party.
"How could I miss this? Your party's a legend, Trevelyath."
"Not everyone agrees, sadly."
He glanced meaningfully at the new bloodstains on the floor.
"Hasdrubal always did know how to hold a grudge.
Or maybe it was a gift. Zommel has been agitating to send a fleet after you, to punish you for crimes against the Eternal City. He has had something of a following."
Sliskus laughed.
"And if he had succeeded, then Vect would have been rid of an admittedly charismatic annoyance."
"Aurelia, your mind is as crooked as ever. It has always been the whetstone against which I sharpen my own not inconsiderable intellect."
He rubbed her cheek, leaving shallow scratches. Malice snorted.
"Flatterer."
She frowned suddenly and touched her cheek. He wondered if she had detected the harsh taste at the back of her throat already. She licked her lips.
"Poison?"
she asked.
"Nothing dangerous. Not for such as we, my lady."
She slapped him, hard enough to draw blood.
"Ask first."
She licked the taste of him from her fingers.
"As sweet as ever, I see."
He rubbed his cheek and smiled.
"I'm delighted you came."
A slave passed by, bearing a tray of drinks, and he took one.
"I was surprised to receive your invitation, I admit," Malice said, sipping from her own drink.
"Especially after I put those Grovian assassins on your trail." "I wondered who was behind that. It was a disappointingly sloppy attempt, Aurelia."
Malice cocked an eyebrow.
"They came highly recommended. However did you escape them, Trevelyath?"
"No. I might possibly have caused their navigational system to malfunction. The last I saw, they were plunging into the heart of their homeworld star. Bit of a joke there."
"Was it?"
"Well, you had to be there."
Sliskus smiled at her over the rim of his goblet.
"I thank you for the diversion, however momentary."
"I thought you might find it entertaining," Malice said.
His smile widened a fraction.
"As I hope you will find this modest celebration entertaining."
Sliskus bowed slightly.
"Now, if you'll excuse me, we must mingle before I make my grand announcement, lest I be accused of monopolizing your time."
He took her hand and brushed his lips across the gilded steel barbs that covered her knuckles before moving to greet his other guests. For the most part, they were a tedious lot. They reeked of ambition, and their desperate politicking offended his sensibilities. Even here, among such splendour, they could not break free of the cage Vect had thrust them into all those millennia ago. The tyrant had trapped them all behind bars of fear and paranoia. All save himself. Like his namesake, he had slithered free. He lived for himself, not for some artificial purpose bestowed by a domineering paranoiac. but he was polite. He traded barbs with clever Thindrak and gifted Zarathis with the recipe for a more potent form of hallucinogen. Borrowing a pair of matched blades from a leering witch, he met another eager gladiatrix in a dance of thorns, though only briefly. A few shallow cuts, and a round of applause later, he was climbing the stairs, beckoning for silence. It came in fits and starts. They all wanted to hear. He drew the silence out, savouring it for a few moments. Then, hands clasped before him, he began. "Midwinter is a special time, or so the old stories say, when the seasons bleed into one another, back when we had seasons, and the line between the living and the dead grows thin and weak. It is a time when hunters seek great prey grown sluggish and torpid. How fitting, then, that we see this time as one to celebrate, for are we not hunters, kinsmen? Are we not the most deadly things in all creation?" He gestured flamboyantly, and there were a few cheers as some of his guests grew overexcited. He nodded indulgently. "When the gods made us, they cast aside their tools and wept. For we are perfect in our lethality and unrivaled in the arts of death. We are the sword that made existence itself bleed, and the wounds we opened in reality will never heal. They stand as memorials to our power." Murmurs now among the cheers. Sly looks passed between rivals. He had them, and he could taste their eagerness. They knew what was coming. It was tradition. Other Archons had hosted similar hunts in their time, but this would be the greatest of them all. "Midwinter has always been our most sacred of times, a joyful indulgence amid the bleakness of death's season, a reminder of what makes life worth living. And so I have invited you all here not simply to partake of my stores, but to indulge in that which sustains us. A hunt, kinsmen, a great and savage hunt, such as few have ever enjoyed." He lifted his goblet high, and his guests lifted theirs in celebration. It had gone beyond anticipation and into expectation. "We shall tell great lies in the days to come, my friends. Even now, coordinates to our hunting grounds are being sent to your vessels, a heavily defended world of savage beasts and even more savage inhabitants, a world of tempests and turbulent seas." He clapped his hands and descended, his robes trailing behind him. At his gesture, a vast photonic image blurred to life above the pleasure garden. A world of greys and blues. A murmur ran through his guests, and he grinned, displaying fashionably sharp teeth. He tossed his half-empty goblet over his shoulder and spread his hands, as if to receive the world. "They call it Fenris, a hearth world for a legion of those crude augmented warriors that the slave races seem to birth by the million." He gestured, and the hollow image began to turn. "It is currently caught in the grip of seasonal upheaval. They are blind, deaf, and dumb. They who fancy themselves predators are now nothing more than prey, and we shall treat them accordingly. We, who at our height once hunted the gods themselves. Shall we lower ourselves, brothers and sisters? Shall we deliver unto them a lesson as to their place in the vastitude of all known space?" A raucous cheer went up at his words. It never failed. The easiest way to win over the average Comorite was to appeal to their vanity. He smiled and reached out, as if to embrace them all. "It will be great fun. But for now, eat, drink, and make merry, my kin. Make a joyful noise, such that those who refused my invitation hear and gnaw their vitals in darkest envy." As the crowd broke apart, Sliskus caught sight of Malice sidling closer and smiled indulgently. Aurelia Malice had a mind as sharp as a blade, coated in poison besides. Even Vect was wary of her, and with good reason, for all they had once supposedly been paramours. Malice was one of the few things Sliskus missed about Cumorra. Of course, Vect had tired of her, as he did all his favourites. He had ejected her from his confidences and left her isolated on the fringe of Comorite society. Sliskus could almost smell the desire for revenge radiating from her. Like many of his guests, she had come hoping to rope him into some scheme or other, just as he had hoped. Among so many plotters, there was bound to be something that might cure him of his ennui. "What did you think of my speech, Aurelia?" he asked, taking her hands. "Magnificent! But then, you have always been a superb orator, Trevelyan." She glanced over her shoulder, and he spotted a colourful figure loitering nearby. He raised a plucked eyebrow as Malice continued. "I wish for you to meet someone, or rather, they wish to meet you."
"I don't recall inviting any of your sort," he said mildly to the figure.
"But you didn't forbid us, either."
The clown danced and strutted about him, half in challenge, half in invitation. He caught a glimpse of Murta watching from nearby. His courtesan looked disconcerted, concerned perhaps that he was going to throw her over for something stranger. Or maybe that he was going to get himself killed before she had a chance to do it. He smiled.
"I suppose I can overlook it. Just this once."
The clown stopped, bobbing on her heels. At least he thought it was a her. She rocked back and forth for a moment, studying him from behind her shimmering mask. She leaned forward.
"I am pleased to hear it, Duke Trevelyan Sliskus, Serpent of the Skyways and Prince of Many Colours."
Her voice reverberated oddly, and he studied her garments more closely. He had dealt with the followers of the Laughing God often enough to know a shadow seer when he saw one. Storytellers and seers, or so he had heard.
"And what is your name, little clown? Something suitably enigmatic, I trust?"
Sliskus drew his blade and laid the flat of it across the Shadow Seer's shoulder. She swatted it aside and ducked beneath his arm. The length of her staff hooked his throat, but gently. She pulled him back, and Sliskus chuckled appreciatively. A moment's pressure, and his throat would be crushed. A warning, or a tease. Perhaps both.
"I am one who walks between the veils of time and space, back and forth, up and down. I have seen black stars rise and cold suns set. I have heard the melodies spun by the eternal pipers in the court of deepest slumber, and tasted the fruits of an impossible tree. Is that name enough, Duke Trevelyan Sliskus?"
"Are those names or stories?"
"Is there a difference between the two? And what are my stories compared to yours, O serpent? You crawl through time, leaving a trail of fire and blood across the body of the universe. So it must be."
Sliskus jerked forward, breaking free of the staff. He spun around, his sword raised, the tip set between where he imagined the Shadow Seer's eyes to be.
"If that is the case, why are you here? What do you wish of me?"
"What makes you think I wish anything?"
"Pragmatism," she laughed.
The sound echoed against itself, as if that mask hid a multitude rather than an individual. She glanced at Malice, and Sliskus frowned. There were stories, there were always stories, that Malice knew more about the Harlequins than most. But he had never given it much thought. What was it to him if Malice entangled herself in the petty schemes of such vagabonds?
"I wish to pass along an ending before the story is begun. Will you forgive me?"
The Shadow Seer battered his sword aside and sidled close. There was a rhythm to her movements, a practiced saunter, as if this were not the first time or even the second that they'd had this confrontation. Sliskus found it aggravating and intriguing in equal measure.
"For such an artist, I would forgive almost anything," he said.
He set the point of his sword against the ground and leaned on it.
"Spoil the story, if you will. I do not draw satisfaction from endings."
"Wise."
Sliskus threw back his head and laughed.
"I have never been accused of that.
And I do not make it an accusation now, merely an observation."
The Shadow Seer cocked her head, and the bells that hung from her cowl clinked softly.
You must take the wolf's heart, O serpent.
She stepped close. Her form seemed to blur and twist. For a moment he thought there were other shapes there, standing in the same spot, like visible echoes, individuals who had never been or ever would be, pieces of stories yet untold. Sliskus hesitated.
And is that the ending you have seen, or the one you desire?
One and the same, one and the same,
the harlequin half sang. Sliskus laughed and stepped back, putting space between them. He could taste the chemicals of the Shadow Seer's Krydan, a minor hallucinogen, and one he had long since developed an immunity to.
The wolf's heart, you say? Easy enough to discern the meaning there. The heart of these Monkey warriors resides in their gene chattel. They need them the way we need fresh materials for the body vats.
So, I am to take their future from them, am I? He laughed again, and sheathed his sword with a flourish.
Delightful! I am to steal fire from gods and meat from the mouths of beasts.
A good story, Malice said.
Sliskus glanced at her, smirking.
I'm only in the good ones.
When he turned back, the Shadow Seer had rejoined the widening gyre, her slim form lost among the kaleidoscope of her troop. He frowned.
She didn't even ask to be dismissed. How deliciously rude!
Planning to punish her, Trevelyath? Malice asked pointedly.
Sliskus chuckled.
Is that jealousy I hear, Aurelia?
Curiosity, Malice said.
He shrugged.
One leads to the other, I have often found.
He looked at her.
Will you join me, then, on this expedition, I mean?
Malice pouted elegantly.
It has been some time since I last participated in a raid. Camorra has its claws tight in my attentions, I fear.
Then it is long past time you indulge yourself.
Sliskus took her hand and kissed it with mocking gentleness.
Come, Aurelia, let us savage the primitives together, as we once did in more innocent times.
We have never been innocent, either of us.
No, we have not, and I am glad of it.
Sliskus brought her hand up and stepped back.
Come, one last saraband before the party's end.
Malice allowed him to draw her into the circle of harlequins.
It would be my pleasure, Trevelyath.
Chapter 8. The Way of Things. 641.M41. The hunt was going well. Arke had tracked his prey through the dense forests that covered the lower slopes of the Azahim Mountains, finally cornering it in a bald patch where the trees began to give way to rocky scree. It had given him a good run, but they were both tired of the chase, and he had brought it to bay at last. The ungulate was a massive beast, battle-scarred and standing head and hands taller than Ake. An enormous rack of antlers rose above its proud skull, like some pagan crown, and its shoulders and chest were nearly three times the size of his own. Its hide was pale with age. Most elk rarely lived so long. This one was either exceedingly lucky or exceedingly tough. Perhaps both. His stomach grumbled. A space marine could go a long time without filling his belly, but too many months in the Et had accustomed him to eating regularly. Then he had always thought hunger made the meat taste better. It had been almost a week since they had been banished. How Grimblood had howled! Ake grinned at the memory. It was no less than he deserved, Jarl or not. And out here was better than in there, anyway. Even if they had to find food for themselves. He bared his fangs and took a step towards the elk. He carried no weapons. His chainblade hung across his back, and his bolt pistol was holstered. He reached for neither. Hands and teeth would suffice.
Well,
he growled,
what are you waiting for?
The elk bugled a challenge. He answered it with a bellow of his own. The moment stretched. Then, with a thunderous snort, it began to bear down on him in a flurry of churned snow, razor-sharp antlers lowered for the charge. The ground shook slightly from the force of its approach. The elk called again as it drew near, and he could smell its musky stink. He braced himself. Even clad as he was in battle plate, the elk nearly outweighed him. He had a dim memory of seeing one of the beasts burst through a heavy palisade wall as if it were no more substantial than a morning mist. He spread his arms as it drew close, and at the last possible moment lunged to meet it with a snarl. The impact rattled through him from muscle to marrow. Even with his armor's internal stabilizers, he was nearly thrown from his feet. He had caught the elk by the antlers, and the servos in his armor whined in protest as he tried to break the beast's massive neck. The animal snorted, and the hot mist of its breath rolled over him, stinging his eyes. Up close, he could make out each and every variety of scar that marked its head and neck. There were claw and fang marks aplenty. There were even the ringed sucker marks of a kraken on its shoulders and forelimbs. It was old, this beast, and had beaten more than its weight in foes. But it would not beat him. There was nothing that walked, swam, or flew that could defeat one of the rout, and especially not him. The elk strained against him, groaning with effort. He began to twist, hoping its neck would break before its antlers did, but he couldn't find the leverage. The prongs soared against the palms of his gauntlets, etching grooves in the ceramite. The beast bugled fiercely, as if in denial. Then, with a scream of effort, it wrenched him off his feet and sent him stumbling to the side. Ake staggered, surprised. It lunged, crashing into him. One of its prongs splintered, but the beast kept going, slamming him back. There was no time to brace himself, and he was soon driven against a tree. The impact jostled ice loose from the branches above, and it pattered down over them. Snarling curses, he clawed at its skull, hoping to break something. But it was like punching the hull of a rhino. He heard a howl and saw grey shapes circling them. Something struck the tree above him, and he glanced up to see a familiar grin. Then Lucas was plunging down, landing on the elk's broad back. The animal screamed as its bones splintered. It spun, trying to fling him off. Lucas caught its antlers and gave a sharp jerk.
"No!" Ake roared. "It was mine!"
Lucas rode it to the ground as it finally succumbed. Even so, Ake stayed well back as its legs twitched and kicked in a final spasm. When it had at last fallen still, Lucas climbed off it and rolled it onto its side.
"A good ending to a good hunt, eh, Pop?" "I was going to kill it," Ake growled.
He flexed his hands, the kill urge still singing through him.
"It was my prey."
"It was our prey," Lucas said.
He was calm, which only made Ake angrier.
"We are a pack, Pop, not lone wolves. We fight together, we hunt together, we feast together, whether you like it or not."
"Is that why you punished Grimblood?"
Ake snarled.
"He stole our kill. How is this any different?"
He slammed a fist against his chest plate.
"Because we all agreed to share the kill, brother," Cudia said, stepping out of the trees. "It wasn't his to steal or yours to have. It was ours."
"Who asked you?"
Ake snapped, glaring at the tall Bloodclaw. Kadir's arrogance grated on him. The tall warrior had assumed leadership as if it were his birthright. Ake wanted to grind his face into the dirt for that. It never ceased to surprise Ake that the others couldn't see that he ought to be in charge. Maybe not Dag. Dag was a half-wit. But Halvar and Einar had more sense. And yet, they were content to trot after Kadir, and Kadir was content to trot after Lucas.
"Enough," Lucas said. "The meat is cooling. Best we share it now."
He drew his combat blade and began to cut open the elk's chest.
"And I would have punched this brute's brains out and already had it dressed and roasting over a fire by the time you caught up with me, Pop."
He grinned at Ake.
"No need for argument, then."
Ake looked at the beast, fighting down his bloodlust.
"It fought hard,"
he growled after a moment.
"Not as hard as you, brother,"
Dag said. The other Bloodclaw was grinning hungrily as he crouched nearby, watching Lucas saw the elk's heart out of its chest cavity. Doug was always hungry. Blood turned the snow pink, and Arke inhaled appreciatively. The smell would carry far and wide, and soon might bring other predators. But they would have dressed and cached the kill by then, as they had done many times since they had left the Ett and lost themselves in the wilds of Azaheim. The tang of Promethium alerted him to Einar's presence. The taciturn warrior clapped him on the shoulder.
"Good hunt," he said. "Good chase. Good meat."
After a moment, Arke nodded, accepting the compliment.
"The best meat."
Lucas stood, the elk's heart in his hands.
"Why is the best meat that which you chase down yourself? Do any of you ever wonder that?"
"No,"
Halvar said. He tapped one of his many totems.
"It is as the All Father wills it."
Lucas nodded.
"Even so, my head is full of questions." "And my belly is empty of meat, trickster. Are you going to share that?"
Arke gestured to the heart.
"If so, be quick about it."
Lucas talked too much. He filled the air with words where none were needed. If Arke didn't know better, he would have suspected that the jackal wolf was getting maudlin. Lucas tore a lump from the muscle and tossed the rest to Arke. He looked out over the wilderness.
"I think it is the wolf in us. Once we fought to prosper. Now we only fight to survive. We sink back into our own shadow. We take legend and lore as the whole truth, and only the truth, and seek to add to them, whatever the cost."
"Are you a philosopher now?"
Arke grunted. Lucas seemed to delight in leading them into metaphorical brambles. Arke had no patience for that. A proper warrior didn't waste time thinking about such things. Not when there was prey to hunt or enemies to kill. They weren't Skjalds. He took his share and passed the heart to Doug. The pale warrior took the lump of meat eagerly and tore a chunk from it. He tossed it in turn to Halvar, who snatched it out of the air with a whoop. As he made to bite into it, Einar tackled him, and the heart plopped into Kadir's waiting hands. The tall Bloodclaw tore off a piece and pitched it overhand back to Arke, who caught the heart with a laugh.
"All the fresh air is getting to you, trickster."
Lucas looked at him.
"Maybe it is."
Lucas tore up a handful of tough grass and raised his hand. Opening his fingers, he let it whirl away in the wind. He inhaled, tasting the storm and the forest. Azaheim rose wild around him, spreading out forever beneath a shroud of black clouds. The mountain stretched across the spine of the world, like a crest of stiff hair on a wolf's back. Besides the seven great peaks that ring the Ett like loyal thanes, there were hundreds of smaller mountains. Those tribes blessed or lucky enough to find sanctuary on the polar continent often made their homes in the shadows of the Ett's smaller kin, down where the air wasn't so thin and the cold not so biting. He looked up. Snow and rain fell hard through the cracks in the canopy, pelting his face. The wind had died down somewhat. The hell winter was losing its hold on the high places as Fenris drew closer to the wolf's eye and the climate warmed. The storms would continue, and the ice would begin to melt. The seas were already lapping at all but the highest shores, and soon many of the tribes would take to the waters, looking for safety. Fenris was beautiful and fierce and untamed, but it could have been so much more.
"Just like us," he murmured. "We could have been something greater."
Behind him, the others ate and talked and laughed. Lucas was glad. A few weeks in the wild would be good for them. Bloodclaws didn't do well with too much confinement. The elk meat rested nicely in his belly, smoothing his thoughts. He studied the forested slope, seeking something familiar. Old pathways, not followed in decades or centuries, lit up in his memory as if he had traversed them only days ago. The mountains rose heavy above the trees, their names solid weights on his memory. Thunder Mountain, the Fire Breather, Brodia, and southwest of it, Krukgard. They loomed up, immense phantoms barely visible in the snow. The names rolled off his tongue as he recited them quietly. As a boy, his mother had told him that wisdom sat in such places, waiting for those who had the wit to listen. The mountains had seen the ocean's form and the clouds take shape, and felt the first kiss of the wind. The mountains were older than Lucas, older than Grimblood, or even Russ. They abided beyond all stories and rites. He spotted the smoke a moment later, rising through the rain and sleet.
There.
He smiled and turned.
Get the rest of that elk up. Tie its hide so we don't lose anything. Where are we going?
Arke demanded.
To pay our respects. Come on, up, up!
He kicked Arke in the backside, jolting the blood claw to his feet. Arke whirled, snarling, but backed down when he saw the smile on Lucas's face. Lucas tapped the young warrior in the chest with a claw tip.
Hloya, brother! Laugh! This is fun, eh? Better than being stuck in the mountain. At least it was dry in there,
Halvar muttered as he heaved himself upright with a rattle of totems and medallions.
A bit of weather will do you good, brother. Air you out a bit.
Lucas reached out and caught Dag by the neck as he rose. He kissed the startled Bloodclaw roughly on the top of the head before releasing him.
It might put some color in those wan cheeks of yours, Dag, and it might even disperse some of those promethium fumes that cling so tightly to poor Einar.
He looked at Kadir and shrugged.
No help for you, though, brother. Not until your hair grows back out.
Kadir touched the shorn side of his scalp and frowned. Before he could reply, Lucas was already moving.
Where are we going, Lucas?
Arke asked again. Lucas grinned at the wariness in the Bloodclaw's voice.
There's a village down there, the Jatvian tribe. I take them gifts sometimes. Food, weapons, little things here and there, when I'm in the area.
You feed them?
Arke looked aghast.
It is Hellwinter.
Lucas peered at him. Arke was just two yellow eyes in the snow and shadows.
The beasts are seeking the safety of high ground as the seas eat the land. Food is scarce, unless you happen to have a taste for kraken.
Arke grimaced. Lucas laughed.
It doesn't taste that bad. All my people used to eat was kraken. I know exactly how it tastes.
Arke glowered at Lucas.
We shouldn't be doing this. It isn't the way of things.
He looked around, seeking support from the others. Lucas laughed.
And who decided that?
You weaken them.
You haven't even seen them,
Lucas said.
And come to that, it's been almost a decade since I last saw them myself.
He shook his head, scattering snow.
Oh, more than a decade. Time slips away when you're not paying attention.
He shrugged.
You don't have to come with me.
Yes, I do.
Arke spat onto the ground.
We're a pack, remember?
Then by all means, follow along.
Lucas hefted the elk up onto his shoulders with ease and started off through the snow. Every so often, the ground shook and the branches cracked and shed ice. While Azaheim was more stable than the rest of the planet's landmasses, it wasn't by much. The Bloodclaws followed him. They walked in silence for a time, until Arke asked,
"Do you do this often?"
It wasn't quite an accusation.
"What?"
"Feed them. Coddle them."
Arke peered at him.
They say you've been banished from the Et at least 6 times over the past 2 centuries. Is this what you do with yourself when you're out here alone?
Lucas shifted the elk's weight.
My interests are many and varied,
he chuckled.
Sometimes I climb the highest peaks and just sit, watching the stars chase one another across the heavens. Other times I put on my helmet and go for a walk in the world sea.
He glanced at Arke slyly.
I have even been to the cavern cities beneath the mountains.
Ake hesitated, at a loss. Halvar spoke up.
That is forbidden. One of Russ's first edicts.
Lucas nodded.
And with good reason, Pops. There are monsters aplenty in those dark tunnels. No place for young blood claws.
The smell of cooking fires and cut wood wafted through the trees. They were getting close.
These aren't the only ones, he said after a moment. Some I don't feed. Some I torment. Only the ones that deserve it, obviously.
Obviously,
Ake said. Lucas glanced at him.
Some of them become arrogant. The ones for whom we are more than myth. The favored tribes. You know them as well as I do, Pops. Ulrich has his pet tribes, as do the other priests. So too do the wolf lords, in their ineffable wisdom. We play at neutrality, but what warrior doesn't favor his own bloodline?
Kadir grunted.
Unlike you, most of us don't remember ours.
Lucas grinned.
Well, whose fault is that? Myself, I managed to avoid that by spreading my favors across many tribes.
He laughed.
Those were good times.
Ake frowned.
You don't still...
Lucas leered at him.
Still what? Play the divine visitor, cloak myself in furs, and trust in the hospitality of mortals the way some do?
He shrugged.
What of it? That wasn't what I meant. I know, but you wouldn't like the answer, so I avoided the question.
Lucas stopped. The trees had thinned, and the slope had degraded into a hilly plain. The mountain rose up into the storm, and the walled steading at its base crouched warily among the foothills. The forest had been cleared back from a stout palisade wall that encircled the steading. The wall was tall and thick, capable of surviving the attentions of an enemy tribe or a hungry troll. The steading straddled a river running down out of the mountain. Several tails of smoke rose above the walls.
Big,
Einar grunted.
That's what happens when you don't have to run for the longships every thaw,
Ake said, somewhat bitterly. He spat.
They're probably farmers.
Someone has to grow the foodstuffs for other tribes to steal,
Lucas said.
I'll go alone from here. You five, stay here, out of sight.
His tone brooked no argument, and to their credit, they didn't try. Not even Ake. Satisfied, Lucas trudged across the uneven ground, scanning it instinctively for any sign of sentries. He didn't expect there to be any, not out in the storm like this. While the sleeting rain felt like pinpricks on his bare face, to a mortal it would be like knives. When he reached the wall, Lucas leapt, catching hold of the top of the palisade and hauling himself and the elk over with ease. He paused at the top. Contrary to Einar's assertion, the steading wasn't large, a few longhouses arranged around the river in the protective shadow of the mountains, just big enough to house a few extended families. Lucas's own tribe hadn't been much larger, even in good years. The river was iced over, but already starting to thaw. Thin serpents of smoke rose from the flues built into the roofs of the longhouses. There was no other sign of life. The temperature was more moderate here, and the mountains and trees blocked the worst of the wind, but it was still cold enough to form a sheath of frost on his armor when he stood in one spot for too long. Lucas leapt from the palisade onto the nearest rooftop. He could hear faint singing rising up from below him. The soles of his boots scraped on the frosted thatch as he made his way carefully up the incline. He nearly lost his balance and cursed softly. The roof creaked beneath his weight, but he had little fear of it breaking beneath him. Fenrisian craftsmanship wasn't pretty, but it was tough, just like the tribes themselves. Lucas crept towards the nearest smoke flue and looked down through it. His enhanced senses easily pierced the thick folds of smoke, and he studied the inhabitants. They were singing and telling stories loudly. The longhouse was crowded, but that was to be expected. Winter was cold, and more bodies meant more warmth. He could smell roasting meat and spilled mead, human sweat, and the ripe odor of unwashed clothes. He pulled the elk off his back and snipped the bindings. He gripped it by one leg and lowered it through the flue, swinging it gently.
"And be welcome to it, my kinsman," he growled softly.
With a twitch of his arm, he sent the heavy body crashing down onto one of the tables below. Men and women cried out in alarm, and he laughed, low and long, as he ran back towards the palisade, not caring now who heard him. Lucas heard the doors to the longhouse crash open as he leapt over the palisade. Then he was running back towards the forest, moving with inhuman speed. No mortal could match the quickness of a warrior of the rout. Given the weather, they likely wouldn't even be able to see him. Even so, he heard the hiss of arrows cutting through the snow. He laughed as he bounded through the trees. The Bloodclaws were waiting on him.
"Think they'll follow you?" Kadir said, peering warily at the steading. "Would you, if you were them?"
Lucas shook his head.
"No, they fear the forest, and with good reason."
"Cowards,"
Arke said. Lucas looked at the young warrior.
"Is that what you think?"
"I would have hunted you,"